Counsel, the Chief Justice will be participating in this appeal. He'll be watching the video. He's just not present with us in the courtroom. We'll now hear the matter captioned in the matter of Stephanie Hand. Can we have appearances of counsel, please?
John McGill on behalf of the respondent, Stephanie Hand.
Thank you.
Hillary Horton on behalf of the Office of Attorney Ethics.
And do we have Ms. Hand in the audience?
Yes.
Ms. Hand, you will have the opportunity, if you wish, to address the court at the end of the proceedings. You may consult, of course, with your counsel to decide if you'd like to do that. You don't have to do that, and that will be your decision at the end. Mr. McGill. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Horton. What am I doing? Thank you.
May it please the court. The Office of Attorney Ethics asked the court to affirm the Disciplinary Review Board's opinion recommending that respondent be disbarred. As the court is aware, the motion for final discipline in this case was remanded by the board to the Office of Attorney Ethics for further proceedings, including an investigation into whether respondent's criminal conduct was contrary to the principles of Wilson and Hollandonner and equated to the knowing misappropriation of escrow funds. Then, in January of 2021, the OAE refiled the motion for final discipline after determining that a plenary investigation was not necessary for the board to determine the legal question of whether respondent's conduct was Hollandonner misappropriation. Hollandonner compels the disbarment of an attorney who knowingly misappropriates escrow funds as a parallel to the knowing misappropriation of client funds disbarment that is mandated under Wilson. The board here determined that respondent's conduct was a Hollandonner violation and recommended to the court that she be disbarred. The board noted that respondent was disbarred on consent in Pennsylvania effective March 10th of 2021, following her pro se submission of a verified statement of resignation, which addressed both her federal misdemeanor failure to file income tax returns, for which this court has already suspended respondent for 1 year effective October 31st, 2018, and her New Jersey criminal convictions for conspiracy and theft by deception, which underlie the instant matter. The OAE does not intend to cover the facts in detail as they were outlined in the OAE's submission and in the board's opinion. I would like to reiterate that following a six-day jury trial, the jury convicted respondent of second-degree conspiracy, second-degree money laundering, and second-degree theft by deception. Respondent was a licensed New Jersey attorney who participated in a mortgage fraud scheme with co-defendants Thomas DeAnna and Julio Concepcion. The scheme centered on the final fraud of the fraudulent sale of real estate. Two properties owned by DeAnna, two straw buyers. Concepcion obtained the stolen IDs for these straw buyers from residents of Puerto Rico and created false documents for the buyers. DeAnna used the fake IDs to obtain mortgages in the name of the straw buyers. The mortgage brokers, deeming the mortgage applications complete, turned them over to lenders who relied on the fake IDs to verify financial information and approve the loans. However, both loans were conditioned on the buyer making a cash down payment of 10% of the purchase price. Respondent served as closing agent on both transactions, purportedly representing the buyers. Another attorney represented DeAnna, the seller, but did not appear at the closing. Although respondent claimed that someone purporting to be the buyer in the first transaction came to her office to sign documents, this buyer did not bring the 10% down payment that the closing was contingent upon. Respondent completed the HUD-1 form falsely certifying that she received the 10% down payment in this transaction, whereas the lender's closing instructions specifically said that the settlement agent, that's respondent, was supposed to obtain the down payment check, deposit into escrow, and certify that the HUD-1 closing statement contained a true and accurate statement of all funds received and disbursed. A representative for the lender testified at the criminal trial that the lender would not have issued the loan proceeds had it known that the 10% down payment was not received. The mortgage proceeds were then dispersed. Respondent paid two existing mortgages in the first transaction on a property that DeAnna had taken out the two mortgages on. She issued a check to a company controlled by Concepcion, allegedly to satisfy outstanding invoices for remodeling work that was not actually done, and issued the remaining funds directly to DeAnna. Respondent received attorney's fees for her role of closing agent in these transactions. It was $1,800 for the first transaction and $2,200 for the second transaction. The second transaction took place a few weeks later and followed pretty much the same template, including a default by the straw buyer after two or three mortgage payments. At sentencing, count one was merged into count two, and respondent was sentenced to a four-year term of imprisonment and a consecutive four-year sentence on count three. However, the appellate division in this case in the criminal proceedings did remand. It reversed the money laundering conviction, but affirmed the theft by deception and conspiracy convictions and remanded for resentencing, at which time Judge Grizzo, the trial judge, sentenced respondent to time served, which did not result in additional prison time. Upon consideration of the second motion for final discipline following the remand, the DRB agreed with the OAE that by serving as closing agent in two transactions and purposely failing to follow the lender's closing instructions, which required receipt of the down payment prior to closing the transaction, respondent improperly dispersed the lender's escrow funds in violation of Holland Honor.
Ms. Horton, could you just slow down a little bit?
Oh, sure. Sorry about that. Respondent, through counsel, argued that the OAE filed the amended motion for final discipline without authorization and had disobeyed the board's October 2020 remand letter to the OAE, a claim that the DRB rejected in its written opinion. The DRB agreed with the OAE that respondent's conduct was a Holland Honor violation, to which disbarment is the invariable result. Moreover, the DRB agreed with the Office of Attorney Ethics that respondent's cumulative criminal and ethics history would support disbarment, and the respondent has a serious disciplinary history of which the court is aware. The first brush with the ethics system occurred in 2010, after which she was admonished for failing to act diligently in her capacity as an attorney for the purchaser of real estate from a buyer who was in bankruptcy by not ascertaining whether the bankruptcy court had approved the sale and by not turning over the proceeds of that sale to that bankruptcy trustee. Then, in 5 years later, in 2015, she was admonished a second time for failure to communicate with a client and for failing to notify that client that her research had revealed that an arbitration decision that she had been retained to appeal was not appealable. Also in 2015, so the same year but another discrete intersection with ethics, she was suspended for one year suspension following her conviction in United States District Court for the District of New Jersey to two misdemeanor counts of failure to file income tax returns. Thus, based primarily on the dictates of In re Holland Honor, but also on the theory of progressive discipline, the OAE respectfully requests that the board's recommendation of disbarment is accepted by this court. The board noted that it was not bound by the holding of one of its cases, Nyhamin, and did not consider the cases citing Nyhamin coming after that to constitute a long line of precedent. When balanced against the clear dictates of Holland Honor itself, as interpreted by Harris, Velossi, and Ulio, the board found that respondent, as escrow agent for the transactions, for the closings, was duty-bound to act as a fiduciary for the lender and hold loan proceeds in escrow until all conditions precedent were met. Instead, respondent made calculated misrepresentations to the lender regarding the receipt and deposit into her attorney trust account of the required 10% buyer cash deposits. The board acknowledged its sometimes inconsistent treatment of the application of Holland Honor to somewhat similar fact patterns, but pointed to the pre-Nyhamin cases in which respondents were routinely disbarred for knowing misappropriation of loan proceeds and the misapplication of entrusted property. And that's Harris, Verlosi, and Ulio. Harris, in particular, can be cited as support for respondent's disbarment. Harris was disbarred following a motion for final discipline, following her convictions in New Jersey State Court to money laundering, conspiracy to commit money laundering, theft by deception, and conspiracy to commit theft by deception. In connection with her role as closing agent in several fraudulent real estate transactions that she conducted on behalf of her client, George Scott. Harris failed to record title and failed to disclose pre-existing mortgages to the lender. She maintained a trust account for the funds that she derived from Scott's fraudulent transactions and drew checks directly payable to Scott. Harris did not pay off liens that she, as she was required to do, and gave all of the funds to Scott or did with it as Scott illegally, fraudulently directed. Harris permitted Scott to abuse her very good reputation in exchange only for business for her struggling law practice. She received nothing more than normal fees for acting as the closing agent in those transactions, and she was ultimately disbarred. Likewise here, as the board found, respondent should be disbarred for the knowing misappropriation of escrow funds. Respondent, in furtherance of a criminal scheme, intentionally induced a lender's wiring of over $800,000 in mortgage proceeds, ignored the lender's specific escrow instructions, and dispersed the mortgage proceeds in accordance with the criminal scheme. Additionally, the board properly noted that respondent's criminal conviction underpinning this offense constitutes the second time that respondent has committed criminal misconduct that has brought her before the board and now ultimately the court. Unlike her first conviction, though, which was for a personal tax offense, this second conviction included respondent leveraging her status as an attorney to perpetrate the mortgage fraud. Even putting aside the niceties of Holland Honor, the seriousness of respondent's criminal convictions would independently support her disbarment. I have nothing further unless the court has questions for me.
Are there any questions of Ms. Horton at this time? We'll hear from you, Mr. McGilvin. Thank you, Ms. Horton.
Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court. Respondent stands before the court having been convicted of criminal conspiracy and theft by deception. As found by the appellate division, respondent's criminal conduct was limited to proffering falsehood statements in two real estate transactions that occurred in 2008 and 2009. As set forth in the procedural history of respondents brief before the court, this matter involves two motions for final discipline filed by the OAE with the board. Clearly, as argued by the OAE in its initial motion for final discipline, respondent's unethical conduct falls within the long line of cases where attorneys were suspended for falsifying documents as part of a real estate closing. And at that time...
I don't mean to interrupt you, Mr. McGill, but I know you're saying that this offense, it was for falsifying, but the jury returned a second degree conviction for theft by deception. Am I mistaken about that?
Well, that was the charges. Yes, Justice Albert.
I just want to know, was that the verdict? It was a verdict of guilty of second degree theft by deception, not just falsifying documents.
That was the verdict, but the conduct found by the appellate division, which constituted the criminal conduct, was the falsifying of HUD certifications. That's what respondent did here. She did nothing more. She did not do like Harris, who did not pay off any of the liens and turned over all of the money.
That, but it's the falsification that led the bank to give money that it otherwise would not have given in excess of $75,000, which is the reason why the jury returned that verdict, correct?
That's correct. The jury, she was charged criminally with theft by deception. That was the jury's verdict. The point I'm trying to make to the court is when we look at the conduct, because as I was stating here, as argued by the OAE in its initial motion for final discipline, respondent's unethical conduct in falsifying the HUD statements falls within the long line of cases where attorneys were suspended for falsifying documents as part of the real estate closing, where the lenders went ahead and, based on those false HUD statements, released the funds, and the funds were dispersed by the closing attorney, no different than what respondent did here. It's just that under that long line of cases, which was the precedent in 2008, 2009, when respondent committed her conduct, attorneys were suspended for falsifying HUD statements. Even those attorneys that were charged with theft by deception based on the falsifying the HUD statements. That's the point that I'm trying to make clear to the court. All right, the conduct is the same conduct. OAE and the board now wants the court to come up with a new rule, announce a new rule, that henceforth, because there is no court decision that has said it as of today, and that's why the board doesn't cite any Supreme Court decision for this proposition, which the board doesn't even admit it's a new rule, okay? The OAE is asking the court to henceforth, when attorneys falsify HUD statements, and based on those false statements, lenders release funds and the attorney disperses those funds, and the lenders would not have released those funds if the HUD statements were not false. OAE and the board want a rule from the court on Ms. Hand's dime, if I may. You know, they want her, they're trying to use her as the poster child, all right, for this new proposition, new law from the court. Henceforth, when attorneys do that, you're going to be disbarred under Hollandiner. And that's the point I'm trying to make. And the OEE, in their initial, I attached it to my brief, in their initial motion for final discipline, they admitted that Ms. Hand's conduct falls within this long line of cases where attorneys were suspended for falsifying documents as part of real estate closings. And at that time of the initial motion for final discipline, the OAE asserted that progressive discipline was not appropriate, because the question was, should Ms. Hand...
Counsel, this is, we're looking at the DRB decision now, mm-hmm. and what the DRB is recommending. And they've looked at the conspiracy and theft by deception convictions in this setting, and they're recommending a penalty right. of disbarment.
Right.
Can you address that? Why is that so off?
I'm trying to, Justice, I'm trying to ask the court's patience with my argument to allow me to go through it, because in our brief, I think I lay it out clearly, okay?
We have your, yes.
And why it is off, as you ask. Why it is inappropriate to visit the disbarment on Ms. Hand, because as I say it in our brief, our position as to whether the court should fashion a new rule, we don't really take a position as to whether the court should fashion a new rule. We rely on the court's discretion. If the court thinks a new rule is necessary for the bar with respect to announce to the bar, be on notice, New Jersey Bar, attorneys who falsify HUD statements, when you do that going forward, and if lenders rely on those false statements and release funds and you disperse those funds, that's going to be considered a misappropriation of funds by itself. That's all that happened here. That's going to be considered a misappropriation under Hollandiner.
Well, what didn't something more happen here? She did not properly represent the facts to the lender when the monies were released.
That's the false certification in the HUD. That is the same, as OAE makes it sound maybe like it's more, they did not represent the true facts. That's the false certifications in the HUD. She certified she received earnest monies, 10% earnest monies that were not received. Attorneys had done that in matters back in 08 and 09. And they were suspended for doing that.
And were those attorneys also convicted of conspiracy as part of a plan that carried out this theft by deception?
But Justice, as the court, I'm sure, is aware, each case is fact-specific in ethics. And I would submit a review of those cases are going to find a panoply of different charges, okay? And I'm not going to stand here and say none of them involve conspiracy or that some of them did. All right, conspiracy is another charge, and we've put in our brief, we take issue with that finding as well. We believe for good cause, because this mastermind of this fraud, Deanna, turned state's evidence to get himself a special deal.
Are you collaterally attacking the criminal conviction now?
I am not.
So this is not the place to do that.
Well, Justice Albin, respectfully hear me. I'm not See, the board tried to in their decision, they take the position I'm collaterally attacking that finding. I mean, Ms. Hand, in front of the board, indicated that she has a post-conviction relief motion that was filed this year. It's still pending. But under, I believe it's the McGrid decision, it's cited in the board's decision, where this court has said it will not look at the facts to collaterally attack those findings, but will look at those facts as to determining what's the appropriate sanction. And that's the reason I raise it, because you have a conspiracy conviction. We submit it's unreliable for the reasons that we argue it's unreliable. Deanna even says, I attached a part of the transcript. We said, I wouldn't testify for the state if I was not going to get this sweetheart deal of probation. And he's the only witness against respondent. I believe the court can take that into consideration in weighing how strong is that weight of that evidence.
It's one thing to talk about some facts, but now you're telling us that the conviction was unreliable?
I'm saying the evidence to support the conspiracy I am submitting to the court is unreliable for the reasons I mentioned. Under the Michael Jackson decision, respondents' counsel did not have the opportunity to cross-examine Deanna.
But that's for a post-conviction relief. We can't decide. We have to accept the conviction that it's before us. My mistake.
And I agree with you, Justice Albin. But what I'm saying the court can do, because you say it in McGrid, you can consider those facts. You can consider that the appellate court and the trial court's finding as to whether Mr. Ashley, respondent's criminal counsel, could cross-examine Deanna as to the full 20-year scope of potential exposure. Under the Michael Jackson decision, which was decided by this court later, the court can say, well, now under our Michael Jackson decision, possibly the appellate division and the trial division's decision, when Michael Jackson wasn't the law at the time, all right, now you have these facts in front of you. You can say, we can take into consideration that respondent did not have the full opportunity to cross-examine this witness in terms of deciding the weight of that evidence. Not that you're disregarding that evidence.
I don't want to debate this with you, but it seems to me that has to be decided in a post-conviction relief application, because it could very well be, even if you're correct on the law, that's not before us, a PCR court could say that on prong two of Strickland, they wouldn't have made a difference. We don't know. This isn't for us today.
Okay. All right. What I'm saying is these issues are before the court in terms of under McGrid, whether you can consider in terms of the appropriate sanction for this respondent, whether that is relevant to you or not. That's all we're saying. And we wanted to bring that issue to the court's attention so you could look at it. I mean, if the court says, well, we find it irrelevant, we have to live with that. But if I didn't raise it, you wouldn't think about it at all. And we believe that there's relevant considerations for this court to consider when you look at this record in terms of looking at those facts as how they relate to the appropriate sanction for respondents' unethical conduct. That's all we're saying. It is relevant. you know, the fact says we present them are what they are. Deanna did say, well, I wouldn't have testified against Ms. Hand unless I got the sweetheart deal. He did say that. We put all that in front of the court. We're not saying that the court should find that there's no conspiracy conviction. That's not our position. We're just saying it's under McGriff. It's relevant for consideration as to the appropriate sanction here. Limited to that. Okay. All right. So, now, I'm going to try to get back to my argument until I get to the next question. At the time of the OAE's original motion for final discipline, when they recommended a one-year suspension, they argued that respondent's case falls into this long line of cases where attorneys were suspended for falsifying documents as part of real estate closings, all right, wherein, based on the false HUDs, monies were released and dispersed, which is the same conduct here that the OAE and the DRB is now saying the court should consider Hollandiner violations. At that time, there was a question as to what respondent sanction should be. The OAE recommended a one-year suspension and argued that they, in their brief, they say, well, there's an issue of progressive discipline because respondent had received two prior admonitions. But we, and what the OAE said is based on the mitigating circumstances, we don't believe progressive discipline is appropriate. However, they recommended a prospective decision. Now they come before this court taking that same conviction and arguing that it's somehow an aggravating factor. You should disbar her on her prior record by itself. And so we're saying to the court, that's sort of disingenuous. There was mitigating circumstances that overrode a consideration of progressive discipline in their initial motion. What happened to those mitigating circumstances now that they're saying, oh, court, you should look at this as an aggravating record of prior discipline. You should disbar because she has two admonitions, one-year suspension, and then the second these next convictions that in the first motion for final discipline, the OAE argued should also be 1 year. And I would note the trial judge in the matter, the criminal matter, that's at issue before the court, and the appellate division found overwhelming mitigating circumstances. And so I would argue to the court that respondent's prior record by itself does not support disbarment. At best, and we don't necessarily agree, because our position is she should get a one-year suspension for the criminal conduct that's before the court, as argued by the OAE and respondent in the initial motion for final discipline. But I would argue if you consider her prior record and consider the progressive discipline principle, that you also look at the mitigating circumstances, but even if you feel, well, then it should be more than the 1 year McGill is asking for this matter, it still should be a suspension of, what, 2 years now, progressive, or 3 years? Usually the court's decisions, once you get past 3 years, now you're talking about either 5 year indeterminate suspension or disbarment. We're not there yet. So the prior record is not, does not provide that support that she should be disbarred, especially when you consider all the mitigation that's involved. Okay, let me try to move on.
But Mr. McGill, in terms of progressive discipline, she had a one-year suspension previously, and that's a very significant sanction. We're not jumping from admonition to consideration of disbarment.
Well, I don't disagree that that's, you know, 1 year is serious. And 1 year was consistent with the failure to file income tax returns.
Right.
That was consistent, and that's what she did. So the case law, and she was on notice of that. That's what the case law said, and that's what she got, the 1 year. But again, OAE found that it should not be more than 1 year when she already had the two admonitions, because of the mitigation that was in the record, and they argued that in the initial motion for final discipline. And then the matter in front of you, again, both the trial court and the appellate court found substantial mitigating circumstances. This Ms. Hand should not be disbarred based on prior discipline and or any other argument offered by the OAE or the DRB. Okay. Now, respondent argued initially in the initial motion for final discipline, as she does in the incident matter, that she receive a retroactive one-year suspension consistent with the long line of falsehood certification cases with which she is similarly situated. Okay. However, based upon the DRB and OAE's quest to advance a new rule of law, where the prior precedents in false certification cases are now repudiated and deemed going forward to constitute misappropriation of escrow funds under Hollandiner, respondent finds herself before the court defending against the recommendation that she be disbarred. Procedurally, in 2013, in matter of Nehemin, the OAE had sought the same new rule of law for conduct similar to that of the respondent, and they sought that in front of the board. However, at the time, the board rejected the OAE's application and recommended a 3-month suspension for Nehemin. Therefore, an important question before this court is, what makes respondent so special that she should receive such disparate treatment from the attorney in Nehemin?
I assume you're going to answer that question for us.
Well, there is no reason she should receive such disparate treatment. It's unfair. Nehemin comes before the board.
Claiming a reliance interest in a prior quantum of discipline from a past case, is that the argument?
I'm sorry.
Is she claiming a reliance interest in the quantum of discipline that may have been imposed on an attorney in the past? Is that the argument?
Part of the argument, yes, just generally. It's in terms of notice. When in 2008-2009, when Ms. Hand committed her conduct, and the OAE in its initial brief before the board cites the cases where similar conduct, where attorneys were suspended. And there was no case, that, as I stand here now, there still is no Supreme Court case that says false certifications in HUDs will be treated as Hollandiner violations under any circumstances. So clearly back in 2008, 2009, there was nothing that put Ms. Hand on notice that if I falsify these HUD certifications, I may be disbarred. There was nothing on notice to anyone. That's an important consideration, and you know, I'm asking this court to care about it, because I know this court does care about its precedent and will give, you know, serious consideration to whatever decision the court comes up with. And that's all we ask for, because we don't believe the board did. We believe the board fashioned an argument to agree with the OAE to present an agenda to the court. They want a new law. And so they're using Ms. Hand as the poster child for that new law. When they had the opportunity to use Nehemin, OAE brought the same argument in Nehemin. The board rejected it. Why now? Why Ms. Hand? Okay, so let me move on. We submit that in 2008-2009, respondent had no prior notice that her conduct in proffering falsehood statements in two real estate transactions could result in her disbarment for knowing misappropriation under Hollandiner. Therefore, to determine that respondent's 2008-2009 conduct now constitutes knowing misappropriation under Hollandiner for which disbarment is appropriate, constitutes both a new rule of law and a new sanction for falsehood certifications.
We understand your point, Mr. McGill. You've made it. Is there something else that you would like to add?
Okay. All right. And the court's aware, we argue any new sanction of disbarment should be applied prospectively and not to Ms. Hand. Okay. Now, there are questions whether the DRB OAE proposed new rule is ripe for the court's consideration. We did not take a position in terms of submitting argument. In all candor, I don't think it was fair to ask Ms. Hand to represent the entire bar on this question. And Nieman should have been the one, or some other procedure, and I'm going to suggest that now. We don't believe the issue is right before the court, because what should the scope of this new law be? Okay. Should lenders' priority lien position be considered? Okay. Does any type of falsehood statement trigger Holland Donner, or only those that affect loan funding? Should the court's rules committee first be consulted? Should the State Bar Real Estate Committee be invited to weigh in as amicus? I mean, the full scope, if you're going to change the law, that false certifications can lead to disbarment. I submit that needs to be looked at further, not based on the board's decision, which I submit is not well written, or the OEE's recommendation. All they want is a rule of disbarment, and then they'll prosecute lawyers who they find that violated the new rule. But the Rules Committee and the State Bar may weigh in for, you know, real estate practitioners. I'm not a real estate practitioner, but there may be nuances. You know, I mean, any false statement where a loan is funded based on the false HUD statement, and let's assume there's no harm to anybody. The buyer pays all their mortgage payments. They don't default like what happened with Deanna and Concepcion here. You know, they make their mortgage payments. There's no harm to anybody, but still, the lender would not have released the funds if there wasn't a false HUD statement. And having released the funds to the attorney, once he disperses them, now it's technically a misappropriation. I think, again, that issue is not ripe because, and those are just some of the questions I could think of. I'm not a real estate practitioner. I submit possibly the State Bar real estate practitioners may want to help to assist the court in defining the scope of any new rule. Okay. Fairness. And these are my final comments. We submit, obviously, that to disbar Ms. Hand when she had no prior notice, her conduct could lead to disbarment under that long line of cases, is fundamentally unfair. We also believe it's unfair for the DRB to single respondent out rather than Nieman, the Nieman attorney, to be the poster child for its proposed new rule of law. We believe it's unfair for the DRB and the OEE to recommend respondent be actively disbarred under this new rule and sanction when, in your Holland Donner decision in Garcia, the court has already stated if there's been no prior announcement of the rule, the attorney whose case is being used to pronounce that rule does not suffer the new sanction because of lack of prior notice. That's just fundamental fairness. By recommending respondents' disbarment, this matter came under the court's exclusive jurisdiction. You know, the court has exclusive jurisdiction over disbarment matters. When the OEE submitted its first motion for final discipline, it was a one-year recommendation of suspension, and we agree with that. The only decision dispute was, should it be prospective 1 year or retroactive 1 year? We argue it should be retroactive based on the overwhelming mitigating circumstances. But as soon as the DRB, because they led this matter and remanded back to the OAE, and the OAE went and brushed off the Nieman argument and brought it now under Ms. Hand's name. As soon as that happened, now the exclusive jurisdiction of the court attached. Now, that being so, the court respondent's appearance in front of the court is required. It wouldn't have been required if she... if the board had recommended a one-year suspension, we could have agreed to that on the papers and just argued. So now she it's required. She lives in Houston. Now she had the added expense that had to now fly from Houston here. That wouldn't have happened.
Excuse me. But if that had been recommended, this court could have issued its own order to show cause and asked for the respondent to appear before her.
Absolutely.
If we felt that there was a possibility that this was a case that called for disbarment.
Absolutely. And if the court, if there was a one-year recommendation and the court did that, I would not be arguing any unfairness under those circumstances.
Well, she did get there has been an order. She is getting her notice and opportunity to be heard today. So well, let's move on.
But Justice, I'm not, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying the court has done anything unfair, okay? This exclusive jurisdiction attached because of the DRB's finding. Once they recommended disbarment, the rule says it automatically comes before the court. I'm not saying the court did anything.
I understand your point. I suggest that you move on to your next.
Okay, well, I'm almost finished. Again, I'm trying to point out what we feel is unfair as the way Ms. Han has been treated.
You have a potential disbarment here. What else would you like to tell us about your client and this matter before this matter resolves? We've gone well past the 15 minutes.
Well, that, you know, the disbarment recommendation here seems to be more of a punishment recommendation by the OAE and the board than anything else. I mean, they're arguing for a new rule. They don't care whether, you know, Ms. Han is disbarred under the new rule or that it's prospective, I would submit. But they're arguing now, oh, her prior record, which when there's substantial mitigation in that prior record, they're arguing she should be disbarred. But that because the three-prong test, Ms. Horton didn't even address that, as I argue in my brief. They argue one prong of a three-prong test, so that test is not met. And this is a new rule, contrary to what the DRB has said. So in terms of, to answer your question, Justice, Ms. Han stands before you with overwhelming mitigating circumstances in the record. The purpose of discipline is not to punish the attorney, but to protect the public. And if you read what the appellate division said and the trial court said about Ms. Han in terms of the mitigating circumstances, it's clear that there's enough mitigation to support the proposition that I make that Ms. Han is no threat to the public going forward, so her disbarment is not necessary to protect the public. The only purpose of disbarment here would be to punish her, and that's not the purpose of discipline, and that would be contrary to the mitigating circumstances that are in the record. So that's basically my argument, other than what I have in my brief, and if there's any further questions, I'd be happy to address the court.
Does anyone have any questions?
No.
If Ms. Han would like to address the court, that's certainly her prerogative. If you'd like to consult with her, please do.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Rabner and honorable members of the court. I appreciate the invitation to address the court and respectfully submit to my counsel on the substantive arguments concerning this matter. Thank you for the opportunity to address the court. My words cannot fully express my personal shame and remorse I feel as a result of the experiences that have brought me here today. I humbly apologize to this court, the bar, my family, my clients, and the public for my conduct in submitting false HUD certifications in this matter. Although I was found guilty of a jury of my peers, I do maintain my innocence with respect to the conspiracy charge. Truthfully, I exercised bad judgment and misplaced trust in connection with these two real estate closings. My conduct failed to meet the high standards expected of members of the bar and weakened both the trust and confidence that the public placed in our profession. However, I submit to this court today that my character is redeemable and that my disbarment is not necessary to protect the public going forward. My journey since the indictment has enlightened me to the privilege that I enjoyed as a licensed attorney. I met many on my journey who could benefit from the assistance of others who have shared a common experience. I commit to this court that I will assist others, regardless of my status as a member of the bar. I prayerfully ask this court to grant my application for retroactive suspension based on the merits and in an interest of justice. It is my absolute truth that I will endeavor the rest of my days to restore both the court and the bar's confidence in my competency and heightened integrity. I rely on the mercy and the sound judgment of this court, and I thank you for taking the time and consideration in this important matter. Thank you, justices.
Are there any questions, Ms. Ann?
Ms. Ann, what have you been doing over the last year or two?
I have been, prior to moving to Houston, Texas 6 months ago, I have been working at a quick service restaurant called Shakura Japan. I started off there as a condition of my ISP, and I started with deliveries. From there, I have been assisting the owner in expanding his business. I've also spent a considerable amount of time working with a not-for-profit Weekway Park Development organization in East Orange that does work for children that are in need. And I have, with the mercy of the grace of God, have been able to see my child off to Howard University, where she's in her third year with a 4.0 average.
Are you residing in New Jersey or?
I have relocated to Houston in the last 6 months. That's where I am. But my future plans are completely in the air.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hand. We'll take the matter under advisement.